It was a dark night when fire broke out in Chelm. The flames reached to the sky, and before the Chelmites succeeded in putting out the fire, it had consumed the better part of a block of buildings and flats on one side of the market square. When, after many hours of fighting the fire with the primitive equipment at their hands, the citizens of Chelm finally were able to rest from their labors, the rabbi of the town climbed up on an overturned cart in the marketplace and began to address the people. "My friends," he said, "this was truly a miracle sent to us from heaven. And even in that city of incredible corporate bungling and foolish wisdom, there were murmurs of puzzlement at this strange declaration." "Yes," he said, "true. The flames were truly a gift from heaven, for had it not been for the flames, we could not have seen how to put out the fire." As you know, when we talked about Cleveland and its too many problems a few weeks ago, I suggested to you that Cleveland had become the Chelm of American folklore. And I keep hearing vibrations of Chelm, both in the media, of course, and in our own conversation. The day after the televised midnight session of the city council, when it was finally proven that there was no plan to deal with some $14 million of debt that the city owed the banks, and default loomed. The very next day, I overheard a conversation in which one of our wise men said to another, "Well, you know, at least now we know how bad things are." Now, what has happened to Cleveland is not unique. We have provided our own Cleveland brand of low humor. Many of the chief actors in this melodrama have been buffoons. But at the same time, what is happening in Cleveland is symptomatic of problems afflicting all the major older urban centers of the United States. All of them have been living beyond their means. In the last decade, prices have gone bounding ahead. Municipal employees have won sizable raises and built-in increases of major impact in pensions and insurance, health and medical insurance and the like. The citizens have demanded a full range of services. And not wanting to disappoint the citizenry and eager always to be reelected, very few leaders, mayors, council leaders, have chosen to bite the bullet and tell the people the truth and work with them to tailor expenditures to income, to find new ways to increase the income, taxes and the like. Rather, in most communities, there's been a form of financial sleight of hand as community after community has tried to paper over the hard and cruel reality by finding one way or another to delay the inevitable or to deny that which is in fact so. Cleveland is only typical. Detroit, Pittsburgh, and Rochester, and Buffalo, and Philadelphia, and New York City, and Baltimore, Chicago, most of the major cities, major older cities and centers of the United States. As each of us knows from our own household accounts, prices have nearly doubled in the last 10 years. And in most of these centers, the cost of city government has quadrupled. Cost of government has gone up, and the tax base has gone down. Throughout the decade, there continued to be the flight of the productive population to suburbia. Not only white flight, but black flight. It's a class flight, not a racial flight so much. The city has lost population. An increasing part of the community is a client population, dependent upon the government for welfare, for services of all kinds. Well over half of the population of the city of Cleveland today is over 55 years of age. The city has lost some 75,000 industrial jobs in the last 10 years. 30% of the retail businesses of Cleveland have closed their doors within the city limits in the same period of time. And for every day, on every day of the last 10 years, three more residences were abandoned in the city of Cleveland. The tax base has gone down, the demands of the community, the needs of the community have gone up. In many instances, the community has lost control of its own financial house. Some years ago, and this is not atypical, the safety forces of Cleveland managed to pass a charter amendment requiring that they be, by some percentage points, the highest paid police and fire force in the state of Ohio. An increasing dependence occurred during the last decade on federal monies. Today, for every dollar which is spent from locally gained taxes and other resources, an additional 60 cents is spent in monies that are returned from the federal government. And these monies are not always predictable, nor are they always designed for the specific purposes that the city believes it most needs filled. During this decade, and this is again not atypical, the leadership, the elected leadership of Cleveland, has by and large chosen not to speak of higher taxes, not to submit levies to the electorate. And when they have, in fact, submitted a levy, Carl Stokes did it once during his second term. It was, in a sense, a bolt out of the blue. There had been no long-term preparation of the community to deal with the serious, real, long-range issues. And he did so only after he had reduced the millage available to the city by transferring some of that to the school system so that a duplicate school levy would not be submitted the same year. Puzzled and having been promised by that mayor, as all subsequent mayors would promise, that there would not be a raise in taxation, the electorate voted that submission down. So over the last decade, there has been no increase in the basic tax income of the city, at least none proportionate to the need. The needs have remained high. Administrators have been unwilling to cut back. Powerful municipal employees' unions have fought any attempt to cut back or to improve the level of services, the level of productivity by the individual worker. And this is the recipe, as you know, if we'd apply this kind of bookkeeping to our private lives for bankruptcy. You can't go on forever spending more than you take in. Now, the way to be reelected is the way to promise higher services, at least continuing services, and no taxes. And whether the mayor was Stokes, or the mayor was Perk, or the mayor was Kucinich, that's precisely the platform which they submitted to the electorate. And yet, it was patently evident, there for all to read and to see, that the city had not the income any longer to sustain the level of expenditures which were being annually dispensed. Oh, there was a great deal of talk about the long-range issues, the social concerns which were bringing all this about. The implosion in the community of a client population. those who need welfare, those who need medical care, those who need social service, those who need the services of a city, those who are not essentially productive. And there was a great deal of talk about the flight to the Sun Belt of our industry. Having taken the advantages of our city, they now want to go someplace else where there is non-unionized or cheaper labor and where they can build a new plant and not have to pay the high costs of labor contracts that are necessary here. And there was talk about the racial problems affecting communities in the north, and there were explanations about aging and deteriorating civic plant needing to be replaced. All these long-range explanations were used, were spoken of constantly. But no one did much about it. And ultimately and fundamentally, the problem which faces these northern cities is a problem of default of leadership. Instead of speaking the truth, hard, unvarnished, cruel truth about the fiscal problems, the mayors of the northern cities, the northeastern cities, chose to find some other way, some sleight of hand way, to create a mirage, as if everything could continue as it was, claiming always each year, well, somehow we managed to balance the budget. New York City, the most famous of the cases of urban fiscal crisis, managed for a while to balance its budget by heavy borrowings from the bank. It maintained its full range of services, which were far greater than any available in any other major city, simply by going to the great banks in the metropolis and borrowing money and when it against its assets. And when it didn't have the money to repay the loan, it rolled the loan over by borrowing from some other bank or reborrowing from that bank. And by 1975, when New York essentially went into default, 15% of all the income available to New York had to be designated simply to pay the interest on the loans which the city had taken out in the decade before. Now, Cleveland chose another way. Cleveland chose not so much to borrow from the banks as to borrow from itself. Cleveland chose to borrow from its future. And it did so largely by floating notes in the money markets, notes designed to bring in monies necessary for capital expenditure, for the waterworks or the sewer system or some other public asset. And then these projects being delayed, transferring monies sitting in escrow for this particular purpose to the operating budget of the city, essentially writing an IOU to itself for monies which had been used up and which were originally designated for some other purpose. Now, of course, in an inflationary time, it would only cost more in the future to do those necessary replacement and rebuilding tasks for which this money had been raised. It would cost the future more. And the city was doing this with the full knowledge that there was no readily available source of income to repay what is now estimated to be some $40 million of dollars, which were diverted from one or another capital fund to operating expenses over the years. And when it seemed imprudent or inadvisable to divert monies in this manner, the city simply ate its young. That is to say, the city took its assets and put them on the market. In 1975, needing money to balance the budget, Mayor Perk took the sewer system and sold the sewer system to the county and received $30 million for it, and that $30 million was quickly used up in maintaining the level of operation that was available to the city. And 2 years later, when more monies were needed, we began the famous or infamous, call it what you will, series of negotiations which had to do with the selling of the municipal electric light plant. Two men from Chelm met in Warsaw. They were good friends. They were there on business. And after exchanging greetings, one reached into his pocket and put out a letter and said, "I just received the most beautiful letter from my wife. Let me show it to you." And the other received the letter and began to read, "My dear husband, Our tubercular son died. I am now incapacitated from illness. I was weakened by nursing him. The money that you left me has been used up for doctor bills. I can't go out into the market to work. There is no money in the house for food. Your loving wife. What's so beautiful about this letter? Oh, said this man who had received the letter, look at the beauty of the script with which my wife wrote to me. The Hebrew is so magnificent. Well, that's essentially what happened in Cleveland, in New York, and elsewhere. We were fascinated by the sleight of hand with which we built this house, this fiscal house of cards. That we forgot the thesaurus that was making us build this house of cards. And when the first cold wind blew, the cards fell on the table, and there was crisis. And the cold winds, it was inevitable that the cold winds should blow. How long would the various communities in the region sit by and watch the water system on which their survival depends being cannibalized and allowed to deteriorate so that monies designed to improve the waterworks should be put into the operating funds of the city? Then, too, much of this money came from the federal government. And as long as we had a mayor who was the one Republican mayor in the whole United States of a major city, and there was a desperately beleaguered Republican president in the White House, Cleveland received a rather largest proportion of the funds that were available. But there was no reason to believe that that would continue, and it did not. Nor was there any reason to believe that these entitlement grants, which were designed for specific purposes, could be diverted from neighborhood block grants to snowplow simply because somebody in Cleveland decided that's what was needed. And finally, our own federal government began to run into its own set of budgetary problems and to cut back on health, education, and welfare kinds of programs, which meant that instead of increasing again the amount of money available to the cities, they were going to cut back. And then ultimately, the people in the money market are no fools, and they recognize that previous bonds had been floated for particular purposes for which the city had not completed. The word of the city was no longer good. Why should credit be extended? And ultimately, the credit rating of the city slipped and then fell. And then we elected a new mayor. And then the mayor proceeded to come into office and to alienate within his first months in office nearly every group in the city on whom any kind of solution to the fiscal crisis must ultimately depend. For no mayor can go it alone, and whatever image he may have of the banking community or the business community or the labor community or the suburban community or the black community, he must work in some way with all of these groups in order to achieve the purposes of fiscal responsibility. There was the crisis. Paradoxically, over a bank loan, Cleveland owes very little money to the banks, but it came. And after the crisis, in one way or another, the shakedown seems to have resulted in two proposals. One is that an increase of 0.5%, from 1% and 1.5% in the income tax. And the second, a proposal to sell the municipal electric light plant. Now, the proposal to increase the tax rate by 0.5% has at least the virtue of catching in its net any number of us who work in the city, though we do not live there. It has at least the virtue of seeing that some of us who take advantage of the city are included among those who must pay the additional cost. But clearly, it's nothing more than a short-term palliative. It's designed to bring in some $37 or $38 million annually. During the first year, in the 1979, if it passes on the 27th of February, will allow it only to be operating for 9 months. It will bring in something on the order of $26 or $27 million. I spent a good bit of time this last week trying to find out what was the anticipated operating deficit of the city. I found you can't ask simple questions. What the answer seems to be, they anticipate a budget of about $140 million next year. If they don't have to repay any money to the capital funds from which they've borrowed money, if the reservoir doesn't slip on its foundations, if the sewer system continues to operate, if they don't have to give major increases to the surviving police and firemen on the force, if they are able to provide the essential services of the city with some reduction in the labor force of the city, then they estimate that there will be a shortfall of about $8 to $10 million in that budget. So the $27 million that they'll get this year will go some way towards balancing the budget. And there's no reason to believe that the government will not cut back its funding to Cleveland, and there's no reason to believe that they will escape all of these emergencies. But at least for the next year and perhaps the second year, a 0.5% of increase in income tax will allow the budget one way or another to be balanced. But ultimately, given the inflationary cycle in which we live, that 0.5% will be eaten up. There are services that you cannot cut back. Decent wages must be paid. Ultimately, other solutions have to be found. And clearly, it is no solution to believe that every 2 years or so you can go back to the folks in the city and ask them to pass an extra addition to their income tax. They are the poorest. 75-80% of the city are on fixed incomes of less than $10,000 a year. How do you expect these people to continue paying these impacted charges for the problems of a whole society has dumped upon them? Ultimately, obviously, other solutions have to be found. And so people have turned to this second seeming solution. And the second solution seems to be a pot of gold. There is a municipal electric light plant. 2 years ago, the mayor was offered $158 million by the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company for that light plant. Let's sell the light plant. $158 million can go a long way. $40 million will repay what we owe the various capital funds from which we have borrowed the money. $14 million or a little more will repay the banks. $5 million will repay the pension program, which is owed that amount of money. We can invest the money and get some interest. It'll go a long way towards righting the problems of the city. The only problem is, as with most pots of gold, that it's more a mirage than a miracle. The opportunity which CEI offered the city was not for $158 million to be paid now. But they offered the city to buy the electrical works for $38 million this year and $4 million to be paid annually for the next 30 years. Well, even $38 million added to the new income tax would go a long way toward solving the immediate problems of the city. But there's a catch here, too. The law requires that all indebtedness of a utility be repaid to the bondholders and people like that before any money goes to the owner of the utility. And it's estimated that this utility owes between $28 and $30 million. So in that first year, Cleveland would receive between $10 and $8 million, and then $4 million a year. Now even that sounds like some money, although against a budget of $140 million, it's a small percentage. But even here, the figures are not what they seem to be. For immediately upon the acquisition of the municipal electric light plant by the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, the bill for street lighting, the bill for lighting the City Hall and the Justice Center and the airport and all of these groups will go up because the rates of CEI are much higher by 30 to 50% than the rates now being paid to the municipal electric light plant. And so that money will be cut back in terms of the costs which the city will incur. And not only will the city incur higher costs, but all the citizens of the city who paid originally for the light plant will incur higher costs, because immediately the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company will go down to the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio and insist on a rate increase because they have a greater investment now in capital. And a capital investment can be translated directly into an increase in one's rates. How much money will ultimately be gotten, how much advantage would be gotten from this opportunity by the city, I can't tell you, but I suspect it's very small. There are those who understand this, though many in Cleveland, I suspect most in Cleveland do not. It seems a Cleveland solution, a Helm solution. Let's sell it. $158 million, we'll pocket it, everything will be well. Those who understand the problem, the financial sides of this, say, go one step further. They say, let's sell the municipal electric light plant because it's a loser. It has been a drain on the city treasury. It cannot generate electricity. It buys electricity from other utilities. Let's simply sell the electric light plant, and at least we won't be having that debit any longer in the future. Now here again, the evidence is helmish, enigmatic. In a submission developed by the First Boston Company for the city of Cleveland, attempt to consolidate their debts and present something to the bond market which might allow the city to solve its fiscal problems, a report was included by a firm of engineers who said that at least for the last 18 months, on a cash flow basis, the electric light company was not losing money, and in fact, over the last year, it claimed it had made some $900,000. Now, the problem here is that this kind of budgetary leisure domain does not include repairs, replacement, deterioration, all the other things which must be considered in a budget, but it does suggest that since the close of down of the generating facility of our light plant, since the mid-70s when the light plant was losing between $8 and $10 million a year, simply as a distribution utility, our utility seems close to at least breaking even. And if this be so, why is there this unconscionable rush to sell the light plant for monies which really will not accrue to the city in any significant fashion? That's an interesting question. And that really goes to the heart of what our attitudes might be towards the second submission to the voters on February 27th to sell the light plant. Now, I confess that until this week, I accepted the conventional wisdom that the light plant was a drain, that we'd get some money, let's sell the light plant, the city can't handle anything anyway, best put into the hands of a private utility and be done with it. But I did a good bit of research during this past week, and I found this research to be, at the very least, surprising and cautionary. It made me feel that we ought not to jump so fast, that I ought to listen to the old bit of Yiddish wisdom, you know, hopnisht. There's not that much of a rush. I discovered that there are in Ohio some 80, a few more, municipal light plants and rural electrical plants. Very few of these 80 plants generate electricity. Most of them are simply distribute electricity, and most of them are financial assets to the community of which they're a part. I discovered that the electrical utility world, which is a very arcane world, has plants which generate electricity, has companies which generate electricity, has companies which transmit electricity, and has companies which distribute electricity. And there are, of course, utilities which do all of these or some of these functions. I'd always assumed that because the municipal light plant is simply a small unit completely surrounded by Cleveland Electric Illuminating, that the Cleveland Municipal Light Plant had simply to buy its power from CEI, and I never understood how, therefore, its rates could be a yardstick for what CEI charged. It had to charge more than it was paying to the company from which it bought the electricity. But it turns out that since a grid of electrical utilities has been established throughout the United States, since all electrical utilities by law now must interconnect, it is completely feasible, indeed it's common practice, for utilities to buy power from some generating source miles away, states away from where they are, and to pass this electrical current to their own company. The verb that these companies use is to wheel the electrical current from, let's say, the hydroelectric generators at Niagara through a whole series of transmission lines to the local distributing center. And hydroelectric power can be bought more cheaply than steam-generated power. And it is totally feasible. Indeed, there have been occasions when the municipal light plant has been able to buy relatively cheap power, buy power much more cheaply than CEI can produce it. And therefore, it can distribute cheap power to the community which it serves. So it is not at all impractical for the city of Cleveland to expect that in time the municipal light plant can be an asset rather than simply a liability. And when we read in our paper that the law director and one of the councilmen in University Heights, angered by what they felt was an arbitrary contract from CEI for the street lighting of University Heights, said, well, let's establish our own lighting distributing facility, that this was not the kind of innocent anger that it seemed to be, that it is quite feasible for a city to do this. And of course, the investor-owned utilities are very much opposed to it. Now, since it is possible for the Cleveland Electric, for the municipal light plant to perhaps in time make some money, and since very little is gained by selling the light plant, are there other issues at work? Why the haste? I have almost an instinctive reaction to whatever Mayor Kucinich proposes, I attempted to dispose. He's his own worst argument. But sometimes you have to look at the issue and not at the person who's trying to involve his individuality, his peculiarities with the issue. And there's another issue here. During the Perk administration in 1975, the city of Cleveland introduced an antitrust action against the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, the Kane Power and Light Company, the Pennsylvania Power Company, and Toledo Edison, who had formed a consortium which is called CAPCO. I'm not quite sure what it stands for. And CAPCO is a company of these major privately owned public utilities designed to generate power, transmit power, distribute power in this area, designed to pool their resources to create nuclear power plants like the Bessie power plant, the Perry power plant, which their individual assets might not have permitted them to do. Now these utilities, these major utilities, routinely transmit electricity between each other. They routinely pool their resources to build generating facilities, to build new transmission facilities. And the charge in this suit is that all five of these companies, collectively and individually, have conspired to put an end to the local, municipal, and rural cooperatives, electrical utilities which exist in these areas in order to gain a total monopoly on the area. Of course, that it is that issue of monopoly which is raised in an antitrust suit. And here the issue becomes complex. Clearly, anybody can bring a suit again for any reason. And clearly, the $330 million of damages which the city of Cleveland asked in 1975 is a number, you know, picked out of the air. But the suit seems to be more than frivolous. And the basis for that statement is a long document I read of about 200 pages, which is a report of a licensing board of the Nuclear Regulatory Agency, which is part of the Atomic Energy Commission, which is charged for writing up the licenses for the distribution of power from nuclear reactors. When CAPCO asked for permission to operate the Bessie and the Davis power plant, the Perry power plants, they had to go to this board to get permission. And the city of Cleveland was allowed to become a party in this licensing procedure. And they made a number of charges against CAPCO and CEI. And interestingly, the licensing board accepted almost entirely the charges which the city of Cleveland had leveled. These charges go back to the early 1960s. In the early 1960s, the city of Cleveland asked for, that the electric illuminating company allow an interconnect to be built between its generating facilities and municipal light plant generating facilities for emergency use. And the interconnect was denied, though it was a matter of public policy that one be established. There's the charge which was accepted in this, by this licensing board, that during a decade, in those areas which in which municipal light plant and CEI compete for customers, the electric illuminating company went into industry and said, we'll rewire your plant, we'll improve the electrical service to your plant if you'll become essentially our client, not offering the same services to industry, to corporations elsewhere in their transmission areas. There's the charge that twice in the early 1970s, Municipal Electric Light Company was able to buy cheap power up in New York State, and utilities were ready to wheel that power to the transmission lines of CEI, and CEI refused to wheel that power into the municipal light plant. There's the charge that when the emergency interconnect was established, CEI operated that emergency connect during a December of 1972 emergency in such a way as to blow out the whole generating capacity of municipal light plant. There's the charge that it has been a matter of recorded corporate policy of CEI to take over the Painesville and Cleveland municipal light plants, the two light plants which are in its area. And finally, there's a charge that when Municipal Light Plant applied for membership in CAPCO, it was arbitrarily denied that membership. And when it applied to CAPCO for membership for the purpose of drawing energy from the nuclear power plants which are being established, CEI responded by saying that the application would not even be considered unless the Municipal Light Plant and the City of Cleveland dropped all existing antitrust charges against the corporation. I'm not a lawyer, but clearly to an untrained layman, these charges seem serious in an antitrust sense. And clearly, Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company is not eager to buy a deteriorating and cannibalized plant simply to have another old facility on its hands. And clearly, there would seem to me, because the case will become moot if, in fact, the sale is approved, there's good reason to allow the suit to go forward, though it's going to take some time. Cleveland will not solve its economic problems by a quick sale of Unilight. There obviously needs to be far more serious public debate of the issue than there has been until now. I find when I discuss this issue with people, most of them simply accept the conventional wisdom, sell it, get the money, and get out. And I think also, the existence of the possibility of the sale and the pot of gold which it implies has diverted our attention to the much more serious issues. And the much more serious issues are this. Cleveland can be expected to do much better in terms of fiscal management, public administration than it has done, clearly. The last several administrations and this one have been totally inadequate in terms of administration of a very large organization, in terms of administration of finances of a major organization. At the same time, the city of Cleveland cannot be expected to pay its own way. We have expected the city to accept all the problems of the area, all the human problems of the area, and we're not willing to pay our share of the cost. For as long as I've been in Cleveland, the state of Ohio has taxed away more money from the city of Cleveland than it has returned to the city. For as long as I've been in Cleveland, the movement out of the productive employed peoples has been from the city. We've taken advantage of the city. We've returned very little of our abundance to the city. The city cannot be expected to pay its own way. And a pure banking procedure, a procedure which is simply one, cut, trim your sails, Cut your budget to what you can honestly expect to get from your own tax base. Such a proposal, I believe, to be immoral. It's impractical. The city cannot meet its welfare needs, its basic needs, human needs, out of its own income. We need some structural changes. We need county government. We need regional government. We need a taxing system which takes from us something and places that money into the use of those areas of the city, which of the community, which have the most desperate need. We need to restructure state taxation procedures so that the state doesn't keep plowing money into the rural areas, but brings more of this money back to the impacted center cities of our community, of our state. And we obviously need a much more certain form of federal financing. Federal financing is both dependent on the federal budget and erratic. It tends to be financing for a particular purpose. And cities compete for the lines, the entitlement procedures the government has determined on. Those may not, in fact, be the areas the city most desperately needs. And the city needs to be able to count on X number of dollars coming to it for general operating purposes. Yes, there needs to be competent fiscal management. Yes, you cannot expect the kinds of people who have been the fiscal managers of the city to run a city of this size. Yes, they have done a poor job. Yes, they ought to be thrown out and another group brought in. But no, that won't solve the problem. The problem is structural. The problem is that we are in the city, but we're not of the city. The problem is that Cleveland is one county, seven counties, call it what you will. It's not just the gerrymandered area which is governed by Mayor Kucinich. And until we find some way to recognize, at least fiscally, this truth, any attempt to make the city of Cleveland live within its budget and make that budget dependent upon which it can raise from its own people is bound to failure. It can be done. It can be done at the expense of cutting the basic services needed by those who most desperately need services. You and I can do without public welfare. People who have nothing else but Social Security may not be able to do so. In the foreseeable future, the municipality which we call Cleveland will only have a population base that will age more and more. It will have a population base which is less and less productive. It will have a population base which will live in increasingly debilitated housing. It will have plant and facilities which are growing old, are already old, and will simply grow older. The needs are there. They're apparent. They're there for all to see. And I don't care what kind of commission is set up by the state or anyone else to oversee the finances of the city. The kind of administrative changes that they will suggest will not solve the problem. They ought to be done, but they will not solve the problem. The problem remains what has been for the last 50 years. We are of Cleveland, but we are parasites. We don't pay our dues. We have designed communities that provide us the services that we need at the level we want those services. We're willing to pay that cost, but we're not willing to pay the cost for the rejected, the other Cleveland. The Cleveland that we don't see and don't want to see, and certainly don't want our rabbi reminding us of. Now, I don't want to live in Chelm. And I don't think you want to live in Chelm, but we do. And we will continue to be in Chelm, the city of corporate bungling and foolish wisdom, until we become wise enough to bestir ourselves and to take and work for and make happen those long-range structural changes which will see that our tax dollar not only provides recreation centers for our children, safe streets for our children, a responsive police force for our needs, but helps to provide those for everyone's needs. Amen.